WLJ Whitehall, Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Morning. This is Northern Light for Wednesday, April 24th. I'm Monica Sandrescu.
And I'm Todd Moe.
We'll take a look at a couple of the issues approved in the state budget agreement this week, like the first ever paid prenatal leave policy in the country.
We'll also hear about a county department that's helping farmers manage their land sustainably, and a conversation with Adirondack Children's author and illustrator Jessica Kane.
She has two new books out and will join us for a celebration of reading and children's books this Saturday at the Messina Public Library. All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Lakeside School at Black Kettle Farm in Essex, New York, a farm and forest Waldorf school offering childcare, pre-K, and kindergarten programs. Learn more at lakesideschoolinessex.org. And by Point Positive, offering entrepreneurs mentoring, education, and startup funding, pointpositiveadk.com.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandrescu.
And I'm Todd Moe. We're going to spend the next few minutes looking at the final state budget that legislators and the governor approved this week. It includes the first ever paid prenatal leave policy in the country. Now, New Yorkers will get 20 hours of paid sick leave for health appointments during pregnancy. Lucy Grindin spoke with SUNY Potsdam professor Lauren Diamond Brown, who studies reproduction, about why prenatal leave is a big deal.
To start off with, many pregnant people work, right? So even if we look at married couples, and there's plenty of people who are having children that are single, but if we just look at, say, married couples, 65% of families, both parents are employed today. They also need to see their maternity care provider a lot. So when you look at sort of a standard schedule of maternity care, you're looking at, I'd say, 10 to 15 visits throughout the course of the pregnancy, and that's if you're low risk. And most jobs don't have that many days of sick leave.
So Governor Hochul initially proposed 40 hours of paid prenatal leave, but the new budget only has 20 hours, which is still more than any other state. But is that enough to cover just the basic prenatal doctor's appointments?
I mean, it depends on lots of factors, right? If you're low risk or high risk, how far you have to travel for those appointments, how long your appointments last. You know, if it took you an hour round trip for travel and you were spending, you know, an hour or an hour and a half, you know, in that visit, combining wait time with the office visit, and you're doing that 10 to 15 visits, that's adding up to, I don't know, 45 hours. So the 20 hours, you know, of paid sick leave isn't quite there. Now, maybe people have sick, you know, days from their job that they can combine with that. But again, they might have to use that for other reasons.
What you said about travel time brings me to my other question, which is, what are some of the biggest barriers to accessing prenatal care for people in the North Country?
Travel is a huge barrier, and that's gotten worse as we've seen a decline, you know, in hospitals that are no longer doing obstetrics care.
This is a sort of broad general question, but who's not getting enough prenatal care in the North Country, and how does that affect them?
People who don't receive prenatal care are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications. Who in the North Country? I don't have data off the top of my head to report that, but broadly speaking, it's probably people who are low income, who don't have transportation. I'm just beginning to recruit participants for a study on perinatal care in the North Country. I'm just starting to put out flyers around the community and advertise, but I'm asking in this survey, you know, if people had prenatal care and when they started it, and a lot of questions about the quality of that care, as well as questions around other unmet social needs. And, you know, if their maternity care was asking them about, you know, things like food security, intimate partner violence, childhood trauma, and then if they were given resources, and then hopefully I'll have data to really directly answer that last question.
How can people participate in this?
It's at tinyurl.com/North Country Birth.
And what do you hope will be the use of that research? What do you hope will come from it?
I'm hoping to use it for advocacy. You know, we have, for instance, one of the few hospitals remaining up here, Canton Potsdam Hospital, doesn't do VBACs, does not offer vaginal birth after cesarean. And that makes our C-section rate in the county really high. We have other kinds of opportunities, I think, to improve our perinatal health care up here, as well as information on sort of if people are connecting to the resources that exist or not, and where are those gaps. I want to use this data to directly improve our perinatal health care and support systems in the county. And, you know, a few concerned citizens is not always persuasive to people in power, but I know that data speaks.
Lauren Diamond Brown teaches sociology at SUNY Potsdam. She spoke with Lucy Grinden.
New York is also the first state to approve a payroll tax credit for local news organizations in its newly approved budget. Starting in 2025, $30 million in tax credits are available to newsrooms each year over 3 years to support journalist salaries. Print and broadcast newsrooms can receive a 50% refundable tax credit for the first $50,000 of an employee's salary. The funds will be split evenly between large and small newsrooms. The bill's sponsor, Senator Brad Hoyleman-Segal of Manhattan, says the tax credit will help the industry hire and retain journalists. He says keeping journalism strong is critical to the health of democracy. More broadly, North Country lawmakers say they saw mixed results in the state budget. Pat Bradley reports for the New York Public News Network.
Assemblyman D. Billy Jones, a Democrat from the 115th District, says he's frustrated the budget came together late, but is pleased that some funding will benefit his district.
I wasn't happy to see, you know, the prison closures, you know, remain in there, but it did. We had taken that out of our one house. Also, there's a lot of money in this budget that they're, you know, going to different places, and I want to see a little more accountability on it, but if we do have a budget, and I was happy to deliver money for my district that supports, you know, education, agricultural, economic development, veteran services.
Assemblyman Matt Simpson is a Republican from the 114th district.
There were good things in that budget, full funding of the Environmental Protection Fund, restoration of the clean water funding. But there are a lot of negatives as well. A lot of programs that are very costly, such as the $2.4 billion to address the migrant issue in New York. You know, I was very disappointed that there weren't any efforts whatsoever to address the affordability issue and the high taxes. You know, this budget doesn't do anything, in my estimation, my opinion, to address any of those issues.
Simpson noted that while affordable housing provisions made progress, the idea was contentious throughout the budget process.
Fundamentally, it doesn't address the underlying issues, which is we need people making wages that can afford the housing that is here, and that we have an environment that is inviting to developers to build starter homes, which we don't see that very often now. And then the affordability, how do we get there? And that's missing out of the governor's plan. But it's part of a bigger issue within the budget. We need those good-paying jobs here in New York, in our communities. We need them in the North Country. And I don't see anything to address that whatsoever.
Senator Jake Ashby, a Republican from the 43rd District, calls the budget a missed opportunity that fails to incentivize people to stay in or move into the state.
We should have seen tax relief on here. And we've actually proposed legislation that I think would help secure this in being able to limit or really make New York State more accountable for its Medicaid funding. But it would have saved potentially up to $2.5 billion. And it would have created the opportunity for the largest property tax decrease in our state's history. I think that would have not only sent the right message to our residents, but also delivered on it.
Senator Dan Steck is a Republican from the 45th District.
I have historically been a supporter of the Environmental Protection Fund, and that maintained flat funding at $400 million. ORDA is continuing to get a significant investment. But on the downside, up to 5 prisons can be closed with 90-day notice. We've seen this before. A lot of people were hoping would be included in the budget, and it was not. With regard to EMS and EMS service, the other thing that did not make any versions of the budget or the final budget are broadband and cell towers. You know, another thing that was a disappointment in the budget is Medicaid reimbursement for hospitals and nursing homes.
Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul swiftly signed the budget bills after government was kept operating with a series of short-term extensions. In Plattsburgh, I'm Pat Bradley for the New York Public News Network.
You're listening to Northern Lights right here on North Country Public Radio. It is 12 minutes past 8. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up, we talk with Adirondack Children's author and illustrator Jessica Laurel Kane about her lifelong love for writing and drawing. That conversation in just a few minutes here on Northern Light.
Music by Hank Soto out of Stony Creek. Northern Light is supported by St. Lawrence Nurseries in Potsdam, providing the North Country with cold, hardy fruit and nut trees for over 100 years. SLNGrow.com. And Fort De La Presentation, helping to educate and recreate historical ventures of interest to the St. Lawrence region, fort1749.org.
Drum had a nearly $2.5 billion impact on the North Country's economy last year. That's a record high since the Development Authority of the North Country and Advocate Drum began tracking the military base's economic impact in 2009. Fort Drum directly employed more than 18,000 military personnel in 2023 across Jefferson, Lewis, and St. Lawrence counties. That makes it the largest single-site employer in New York State. However, direct employment numbers have been trending downwards since they peaked in 2010. The report also estimated that the base supports nearly 6,000 other jobs in the Tri-County area. They're mostly in construction, healthcare, social services, and education. Those jobs have also declined over the last decade.
An independent candidate for New York's 21st Congressional District filed a lawsuit over the weekend regarding his 2019 televised arrest. Scott Philip Lewis of Lake Placid is representing himself in court after he claims police, media companies, and local governments in Texas mistreated him during his arrest. That's according to the complaint he shared with the Watertown Daily Times. Lewis was arrested on the since-canceled Live PD television show on suspicion of drunk driving near Austin, Texas. All charges against Lewis were dropped due to insufficient evidence. Lewis claims being filmed without his consent triggered a panic attack that led to his shoulder being broken by a jailer trying to restrain him.
And the village of Canton wants residents to leave their lawn mowers in the garage this May. According to North Country Now, Canton officials say grown-out grass helps pollinators like bees and butterflies thrive by protecting their habitats and increasing the supply of nectar. Honeybees alone account for billions of dollars worth of agricultural productivity nationwide. Normally, grass in the village of Canton is not allowed to grow taller than 10 inches. However, the village says they won't enforce that rule until June.
Farmers depend on the land for their livelihoods, but farming in the North Country doesn't come without challenges. Too much water or too little, bugs that want to eat everything you grow. Dealing with all this while staying in business is no small feat. One county department in the Adirondacks is tasked with helping farmers manage their natural resources and tread more lightly on the land. Anna Williams-Bergen has this North Country at Work story.
It's a sunny spring day in eastern Essex County. Farm fields stretch out in front of us, bare and muddy from a recent snowmelt.
Pretty wet here, but that's just spring.
Alice Halloran runs the Essex County Soil and Water Conservation District. These offices exist in each county to help protect natural resources. That can mean a lot of different things: dealing with invasive species, fixing drainage issues, and helping keep waterways clean. In Essex County, a lot of their work is helping farms.
We come out, you know, see what they have, you know, what are their facilities, what are the fields like, and then what are the waterways nearby. What are the concerns with those waterways? You know, is it sediment concerns, nutrient concerns? And just take an inventory, really.
Full and By Farm grows organic veggies and raises livestock for its community-supported agriculture program. Halloran and her technicians have been working with them to help fix a couple different issues.
There was a really dry year, and so they were short on water. But they also sometimes have a lot of water running through their fields when it's a wet year. So what we did was enhance the drainage above the fields where the water's coming off the mountainside and direct it into this pond and then hold it so they can use it for irrigation when they need it.
We're walking through the fields, which are wet from spring melt. It's the time of year when the snow is gone, but nothing started growing yet, so dead grass crunches under our feet. Daniel Burhide is a district technician with the Soil and Water Conservation District. He shows me what's left of cover crops planted last fall.
So there's a lot of residual material, vegetation left over from their cropping, and you can see how, quality of the soil. There's not any erosion occurring. It looks a little drier, a little more manageable than those areas that aren't covered.
At the bottom of the field, a gravel walkway spans over a big drainage tube set into a ditch.
We'll walk down here across the stream crossing.
Water from a small stream flows underneath. This crossing is new. The Conservation District helped put it in last year. Halloran and Burhide are happy to see that it's held up through the spring melt.
You can imagine that either moving tractors or equipment and animals across here without a crossing means then that there's going to be more erosion potential, more degradation of the crossing, and then that goes again into this beautiful stream that contributes to the Bulkhead and contributes to Lake Champlain.
A lot of their work is making small changes like this. Burhide says that one crossing might not seem like a huge deal, but it can make a really big difference. Halloran says her daughter teases her for spotting drainage issues everywhere they go. It even happens when we're walking back from the farm.
It's cold. And maybe you're right. I think maybe it is because of drainage that's over here.
I think he was talking about ditching.
Yeah.
The folks at Soil and Water know most farmers in the county by name. As we drive back to their office, Berhide and Halloran point out fields left and right. It seems like there's someone they've worked with around every corner.
Everything we do is related to how we use the land, so we have to produce food, right? Our farms are so focused on production and trying to stay in the black that addressing resource concerns is not always their primary. That's where we come in, just helping them as they keep trying to produce and manage the land.
Their services aren't just for farmers. Any landowner can ask the Conservation District for help. But Halloran says many farms in the area are especially concerned about adapting to climate change and lessening their environmental impacts. But these projects can be complicated and expensive. A big part of what conservation districts do is help connect farms with resources, grants, engineers, you name it.
Lots of planning, lots of connecting with other organizations, and lots of paperwork in the background.
Berhide says that Essex County is a great place to work in conservation.
We're really lucky in this area because I think everyone, whether they're a farmer or just a landowner, sees themselves as a steward to that property, to the land, to sort of the landscape of the Adirondacks.
The Conservation District doesn't just work with farms. There's also environmental education for kids, planting trees, and a lot of work with highway departments. They say it's all part of getting people thinking about and protecting our natural resources. For North Country Public Radio's North Country at Work project, I'm Anna Williams-Bergen in Essex.
North Country at Work is a long-running project of NCPR that collects photos and stories about working life in our region. If you have a work story you'd like to share, email us, work@ncpr.org.
You're listening to Northern Lights right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, the magic of writing and illustrating children's books. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note, a profile of North America's smallest dabbling duck. The green-winged teal weighs less than a pound, and we'll find out more about it coming up at 8:42. But first, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Clouds and scattered showers, or what the Weather Service calls a wintry mix today. Highs mid to upper 40s this afternoon, winds out of the southwest. Tomorrow and Friday, sunshine, highs in the 40s and 50s, highs in the 60s, Saturday and Sunday with occasional showers, and could see highs in the 70s near 80 on Monday with scattered showers and light winds out of the southwest. Right now in Canton, showers, 47 degrees.
Join us for a special Northern Light event this Saturday morning at the Messina Public Library. As part of National Library Week, you're invited to a story time for kids with three North Country children's authors, Rebecca Donnelly, Maxwell Eaton III, and Jessica Laurel Kane. They'll read from their books and host kids' activities at the Messina Public Library from 10 to noon this Saturday morning. It's free and open to everyone. So over the next few mornings, we're catching up with the authors and introducing them to you.
Yeah, Jessica Laurel Kane is a writer and illustrator in the Southern Adirondacks. She and her family relocated to Brant Lake in the Lake George area from Brooklyn about a dozen years ago. That's when she started having ideas for children's stories. She's written and illustrated several books that offer insight and understanding on growing up, finding one's place, dealing with grief, and how to forgive. Her two newest books are The Boy with a Heavy Suitcase and Once Upon an Upset. Jessica told me she's always been a writer. Her mother was an artist, and since Jessica was 6 or 7, she wanted to be a published author. But even as an adult, it's been a challenge.
And then I started hearing about people who could do the stuff themselves, and that really appealed to me. I can recall, even as a young girl, around that time, 7, 8, I had this amazing teacher, and she taught us how to bind our own books. I mean, that was just the most exciting thing to me. Like, I could write, I could make an image, and then I could learn how to sew pages together and make the own cover, my own cover, and then actually have a whole book. I was so excited. I took that book, I made multiple copies, and I started marching around my neighborhood trying to sell my book door to door. I think the only person who bought one was my grandmother, but I I loved the process. And then as I got older, I just, you know, and I started realizing that the traditional publishing world wasn't receptive to my ideas. I mean, I could have kept pursuing it, but I started getting that passion again. Oh my gosh, I can write my own books and bind them myself. I got a little nuts because I went to such an extreme. My first book, I did 1,000 of them, and I actually sewed the binding myself. I made art books. I learned how to make like a plaque for the top. I bound it in velvet. I mean, it was just like reinventing the wheel way too much. And then I realized this isn't the way I want to go. But the whole vision, I love that spirit of independent, truly independent publishing. And well, so I think that would be what I'd want to share with the kids, too. Don't wait for someone else's approval. Don't wait for someone else's validation. We can actually validate ourselves, and we can and let our ideas come out of our being and share them. You know, this whole idea of ideas being marketed and commercialized, that's a thing in itself, and it has a place and a space and all that. But we can create our ideas and share them, and that's really exciting stuff.
That is so inspiring, and thank you. I loved how you just sort of said, you know, that's part of my message for the event on the 27th is letting kids know, don't let somebody tell you you can't do it. You know, just if you've got that passion inside of you, just do it.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about, you've got two new books, and I want to give you a chance to talk about those. There's one called The Boy with the Heavy Suitcase. I read through it, and the illustrations are just spot on, and it's so cool to see your writing and your illustrations. Even as an adult, Jessica, I read the book, and there's a lesson in there, I think, for people of all ages.
Yeah, I appreciate you reading it and taking the time to read it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like in some ways, I feel like all my books are written for my younger selves. I'm big into that lens to see life through as mm-hmm. our bodies is a collection of younger selves, younger experiences, and learning to reparent those younger selves, to get rid of those constraints so that we can share and not need that validation or that letter A and all that. But The Boy with the Heavy Suitcase was something that spoke to my current self and my younger selves and how easy it is to really lug around some unresolved upsets because we were never taught that there was another way to lighten the load, get support, get a friend, be willing to share what's real for us and the weightlessness that comes from that. So I took a risk to make a book that was kind of, a little bit ethereal, I guess. I don't know. I mean, the boy's walking around with the literal suitcase, mm-hmm. but my hope was that it would kind of plant a seed in kids and adults. So that was that book. Yeah.
It does seem like as humans, it's more difficult, I guess, in terms of what we hear from others. If it's positive or negative, it seems like the negativity is harder to get rid of that negative suitcase.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is so true. And I think that what you just said is the theme of my entire other book. Once Upon an Upset. It's stories and exercises and essays all about getting into that subject. How do we take inventory of what we've internalized? How do we know which stuff is ours? How do we know which stuff is stuff that toxic people implanted in us, not on purpose, but because that's what they received from others in their proverbial suitcase. Mm-hmm. How can we figure out how to make our own values, to take the risk and make choices based on what's meaningful to ourselves?